Time again for Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntris here, and today we're talking with John Ostrander. Star Wars Legacy is reaching the end of its fourth year. The current arc is Monster, and John says it's a great place to jump on the series. We're going to be talking about the book. John's been busy lately at DC writing some familiar characters like the Suicide Squad and Deadshot in particular. He just wrapped up a great three-issue run on Secret Six that tied into Blackest Night and had the Six facing the Suicide Squad. We also can't pass the chance to talk about Grimjack, Mundan's Bar, a look back at his great series for DC with Del Close, Wasteland, new books involving Grimjack and Mundan's Bar. We talk about those projects coming up, the showcase presentation of Suicide Squad that's coming up later this summer. Fans may remember John had a rough personal 2009. He had glaucoma surgery, but things are looking better. He tells us how he's feeling these days. And the good news is he is back at the computer writing new stories. The last time we talked, you were winding down your work on, I want to say, Star Wars Republic, and Legacy was still about a year away.
We're in the high 40s now.
Yeah, and Monster is wrapping up.
Yeah.
I'm reading it in trade, and so I'm caught up with Tatooine, but I have been peeking and seeing what's happening with Monster.
Oh.
So, yeah. Cool. Cool stuff going on. I want to talk about Tatooine, because I really think that's a great place to jump in.
Yeah, I think my ways it is.
So, because, you know, now this is, for people who don't know about Star Wars Legacy, tell us, Kate Skywalker, it's Skywalker, this is 137 years after the events of Jedi?
Actually, probably 137 after A New Hope.
Okay.
Although maybe after Jedi, I've lost track. Well, we got a new Skywalker, we got a new Empire, we got more Sith, and the galaxy, as usual, is really screwed up.
Kate has some Jedi in him. Certainly, it's part.
Yes, he was trained as a Jedi, and then there was this big war that was basically manufactured by the Sith, who were in hiding at the time. During the middle of the war, the Sith emerged, so the Jedi knew exactly who was behind it. But the Jedi were on the losing side, which was the Galactic Alliance, which is the heir to the Republic. I should mention that on the other side is the Reformed Empire, which was actually, you know, a beneficial group, or, well, not a very bad group. But the Empire and the Galactic Alliance were manipulated into this war by the Sith, who were off stage at that point. And then the Sith came on stage and joined up with the Empire, although the new Emperor is not particularly fond of them, doesn't trust them, doesn't like them, but his admirals, the Moffs and stuff like that, were in favor of it. They wanted war, so he really had no choice. So like I said, the Jedi were on the losing end. Then there was a massacre. A lot of them, not all of them, but at least half, you know, I would figure, you know, got killed in it. And Cade barely survived it. His father was killed during the attack. Cade then fell out of the Jedi. You know, he joined up with a pirate named Rav, R-A-V, and became friends with this guy by the name of Jiraiya Sin, and eventually the two of them left Rav and became bounty hunters. But when we started the series, nobody really knew that Cade was Cade Skywalker. He was only going by his one name. Since then, a lot of poodoo has hit the fan.
Yeah, as I say, there are eight collections now, and Monster is the current arc, and in a lot of ways that revisits a lot of some of the first events, because it's an examination of Cade's father and one of his great failures in terraforming a planet, correct?
Right. He was planning, there had been this previous big war involving this group called the Yuuzhan Vong, and Kal Skywalker, Cade's father, was trying to rehabilitate the Vong by getting them to participate in this terraforming project. And the terraforming project, the Sith managed to poison it, basically sabotage it, so that it all went wrong, and that's what initially ignited this big war. And we're back, actually, at the first planet where, in the current series, Monster, where it all went wrong first.
It's almost been 5 years now doing Legacy. And it sounds like it's well-received. Maybe this is a good idea to set it that far in the future where, you know, you don't have to worry about, you know, what may happen on a film or a television series to kind of muck things up for you.
Yeah, well, that was very much the case. You know, in a lot of Star Wars, you can trip all over continuity. And we're not trying to ignore continuity. I mean, we do incorporate
clearly
elements into our story.
Absolutely.
But it's, you know, it's about having a little freedom to, well, sort of redefine, re-explore. And the really nice thing about it is that for our readers, unlike, say, like with the when the last trilogy was filmed, well, you knew how it all ended.
Right.
So, and I'm not putting down what they did. You know, it's all a question of, well, okay, how did we get to that point? But it's been a long time since there was a Star Wars stories where you didn't know how it was going to end. And I think that's been very attractive to the readers, you know, not knowing, well, okay, well, where they're going to go next, you know, how they're going to get out of this, who's going to survive, who's not going to survive. So it gives us a chance to, and gives the reader, I think, a chance to re-experience Star Wars, you know, for the first time again.
Sure.
Bring an element of the unknown to it.
Well, and Cade himself has, I think, traces of Luke, Han, and even Anakin, both the good and bad sides of Anakin, and I think that's what makes him an interesting character. We see it in Tatooine. He has a conversation with Luke in kind of the same sense that Luke would have a conversation with Obi-Wan after Obi-Wan was killed.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cade's on this, you know, kind of on his own path. And, you know, Luke pretty much says, you know, your future is unwritten and, you know, your way could go a bunch of different ways. So,
yeah.
It is kind of fun to see. And that, you know, clearly there's a good chance that, you know, Cade could end up being the bad guy as well as the hero.
Yeah. 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 The nice thing about having Anakin is the fact that there's that in the history of the Star Wars saga. So, and Cade has a penchant for doing things quick and cheap, you know, he doesn't particularly think the dark side is being something that you should avoid necessarily. You know, he thinks that it is a tool that could be useful, and so he dips into it from time to time. And there are those who are telling him, "This is not a real good idea, given your family history, pal."
And he has the full Jedi powers as well. And
yes, he does.
And in fact, in Tatooine,
he's quite powerful in the Force.
Yes, and we even see him, you know, perform an easy Jedi mind trick at the beginning of Tatooine on an Imperial captain that kind of looks like another franchise captain. I don't know. There's a similarity in a name there that makes me scratch my head, and I think a look there. I don't want to get you in trouble. I don't want anyone coming after you. But
well,
you know, it made me laugh.
Then let me neither confirm nor deny.
No, this is really great, and I think that when Monster is collected, and that'll happen later this year, I think Tatooine and Monster are really good jumping on points for people.
Yeah, Monster in particular, like, I don't want to give too much away in terms of it, but John, you may want to go out and find the other issues and read this one before the trade paperback. This is going to be a big one.
It sounds like, yeah, they're a turning point. I mean, I went on the website, and I happen to be reading what's going on, so I'm going to catch up, John, and I hope that when you come, you're coming to C2E2?
I think so, yeah. I'm hoping to. You know, I got to arrange my ticket, and I got to make sure I'm in the area and stuff like that, but yeah, I would like to be if I can.
Well, I hope to have been caught up by the time I see you, because, mm-hmm. And if not by then certainly maybe by the New York convention.
Yeah.
Because, I feel like I need to. And what I've always enjoyed is I've always been able to go back to not only on Legacy but also on Republic and pick up the single issues that you kind of do in between long arcs.
Uh-huh.
And they're always really great stories. And I think when we talk about your recent DC work as well, uh-huh. I really think you have the single issue story mastered in a lot of ways that I think other newer writers really can't accomplish yet.
Well, I simply have a lot of experience in doing it. You know, and there's always fun in that particular form as well. In Legacy, you know, when Jan, you know, needs a break and stuff like that, we do stories. But by touching on some of the other characters and cast members there, you know, we've really widened and deepened the story, I think, because it's all tied in. So I'm very pleased with, like, the single or sometimes two-issue story that we'll do at that point, that even if it isn't focused on Cade, really ties the whole galaxy together and really makes what's happening far richer, I think.
And with a series that's now in the late 40s, my guess is that the Star Wars, you know, audience likes the book and that the book's been a good success.
Yeah, I don't know what the sales numbers are right now. I do know that across the board, you know, all comics have taken a hit in this past year, you know, since the recession started.
Sure.
So, but I think just the amount of excitement that's talked about, you know, again, the eagerness with which our fans are looking at it, at each issue, you know, really indicates that we're tapping into something there. But I'd also like to emphasize the fact that because I've run into some people who go, well, I like your work, but I just won't read Star Wars. And I'm going, why not? These are great comics. They're good stories, interesting characters. A lot happens, and you don't have to have had read all of the other Star Wars continuity in it. You know, like, these are just good comics. So I don't know why you wouldn't want to read them.
Well, you and Jan are doing a great job, and the people that fill in when Jan's not doing the art. It's great to see good space opera being done well in comics, and I think that's not easy to do. And obviously, you know, you even going back to Grimjack, you know, you've played in sci-fi before.
Mm-hmm.
And now 15 years or so doing Star Wars?
Jeez, I know it's more than 10.
Okay.
At this point. Yeah, so we've been doing, you know, quite a number of years. I mean, we're talking about at least 4 years on Legacy alone right now.
Very cool, man. I read on Wikipedia just how the formation of Legacy, so you tell me what's real and what's wrong. But
okay.
It sounded like, especially at the beginning, you kind of put yourself out there for the online community to say, give us a chance and answer, you know, a lot of initial questions about the series and what you guys were planning on doing with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for some people, there initially, you know, there was a very guarded or even negative response. You know, some people still feel, you know, like that by having more Sith again and stuff, that we were undoing or trampling on Luke Skywalker, which I think is far from the case, and I felt so at the time. I will say that a lot of people who were, you know, voicing concerns at the start have become big fans since then. I mean, they've written me and told me, you know, like, I've been in touch with them. So, like, and the only thing we ever said was, give it a chance. Take a look at what we're actually doing before you make up your mind that you don't like it. And in general, because I will say, you know, like, this is sometimes something on the internet community that I see, is that people say, well, I haven't actually read something or I haven't seen it, but I think there's a problem this way. I'm going, no. You know, like, before you really want to critique something, you got to go read it, look at it. You know, like, if it's a movie, see it. If it's the music, listen to it. You know, before you have a right to criticize. But, of course, on the internet, that's not necessarily true.
Absolutely not. No, I understand. The other good thing is not only great writing, but, again, with Jan and the other artists as well,
yeah,
really beautiful images. And
oh,
great,
yeah,
great ship designs, great building and structure designs. I mean, you know, it's a feast for the eyes. This is great stuff.
It's Jan's absolute best work of her career. You know, and, it's also, and that's been a long career. I mean, if you take a look at the storytelling from panel to panel, the panel layouts, how she expresses things through not only facial expression but also body language, you know, the amount of detail that she puts in, so you have a real sense of place and locale. You know, this is all part of storytelling, and Jan has just proven herself, you know, to be a superb storyteller. Again, whether you're into Star Wars or not, this is just wonderful comic book storytelling.
Tatooine was awesome. Storms was great, too. And it was great to see the Calamari back.
Yeah. Well, it may sound like hype, but our best stuff is just coming up now.
Cool. Obviously, people want to know how you're doing. How is your health right now?
My health is fine. You know, I had the eye surgeries, and while they don't restore vision, you know, they're designed to keep me from losing any more vision.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the eye pressures are down to where my doctor's pleased with them. You know, and that means that there is not further erosion of the optic nerve. So that's all good. You know, my vision at this point, I don't have great night vision. You know, I can function a bit.
Okay.
You know, I mean, if I absolutely had to, you know, I can. But I generally, for instance, don't drive after dark because that'd be a little nerve-wracking on me and maybe some of the other motorists. So I'm basically fine. You know, it's I'm certainly getting a little older, but you know, we all get things from the cranky bits of the body.
I understand. Well, and let me ask, you know, are you able to watch a film at a theater?
Sure.
And everything? Okay, fine. So it's
sure,
just,
sure,
it really
yeah,
is
sure.
more
and
of
I can work
it,
on my computer, and, you
okay.
know, there's no problem with that.
Okay.
I was even able to go in and see Avatar. I saw the 3D thing of it, and
what'd
had
you think?
A great time.
It was okay, because I, you know, I still haven't seen it. I've heard so many mixed things, and I'm kicking myself. I should really, you know, try as quickly as I can while it's still in 3D in the theater.
Yeah. Oh, yes, definitely. This is something you definitely need to see on the big screen, and you should see it in 3D if at all possible. But something that we were talking about earlier about some people on the internet criticizing something. I read an article today where the local film critic was talking to people, you know, who said, well, you know, James Cameron is stealing from this or stealing from that. And this one guy said, well, I haven't seen the film yet, but I've read the comments and stuff. Well, then you don't know what you're talking about. You know, basically, it's like, no, you got to, you know, you have to experience it. You have to go in and see, you know, how it works, how it all is put together. You know, is it an effective film? Does he have a viewpoint that's his? You know, it doesn't matter, I think, whether this story element is borrowed from this or this story element is borrowed from that. It's basically, how does it stand well together? And, you know, I was once in the middle of watching Barb Wire, God help me.
Pam Anderson, absolutely.
Yeah. And you watch it to see whether or not she's going to take her top off. I mean, it's all purpose of watching a Pam Anderson movie. But I came in a little late, so I'm sort of watching it, and this creeping realization was growing on me. I was going, no, this is, they didn't. But yeah, it's Casablanca.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Crazy.
Oh, yeah, you can go almost scene by scene, and it's adapted.
Interesting.
You can see the adaptation. And Pamela Lee Anderson is playing the Humphrey Bogart part.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Which, just in terms of total cheese factor, makes it totally worth seeing.
Oh, that's very funny. Well, and I was thinking, too, to be honest, A New Hope. I mean, you know, there are shots in A New Hope that it's pretty obvious. There's the beginning of The Searchers.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's been well documented. And, you know, just put the two next to each other and you can clearly see it. And, again, that's no knock against Lucas and what he did. As you say, it's the sum of the parts that
yeah.
matters.
Yeah, so. Yeah. You may borrow a touch of this, a touch of that. I mean, in my stories, I've borrowed things or maybe an incident from history. You know, may have kicked off the idea. You know, it's what you do with it. And do you make it a coherent story? And do you present your own point of view using the elements? You know, there's what somebody said once, it's like, what, 9-10 plots or something, you know, they were able to define it all. It's all a matter of how you manipulate the elements.
And Mundin's Bar certainly, you know, can sit next to Mos Eisley, and I always wonder that if some of your Grimdrak writing, you know, helped prepare you to do this kind of Star Wars kind of intermingling with aliens.
Yeah,
writing.
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, I think Grimdrak came out before Star Wars, but I could be wrong.
Well, that's what I was trying to sort out as well, John. I don't remember when you started Grimjack. What year specifically?
It was
pretty early.
When did Star Wars first come out?
Well, 77.
Oh, well, okay, then Star Wars maybe predates it. And certainly I could see similarities between the canteen scenes, although the real genesis for Mundus Bar is the fact that I've spent time in bars.
You know, and one in particular in Chicago that we were both the Bucket.
The late lamented Bucket.
Absolutely. Man, there's great pictures and video. Have you seen some of that video online of Joe?
Yeah, I've seen some of it. Yeah.
That's pretty neat. I was, you know, when I was prepping for this interview, I looked online, and yeah, I'm glad to say that there is a lot of video of the Bucket of Suds, which, I mean, it's, you know, I know you and Mike Gold and others have, you know, written at the back of the Grimjack trades and back in the Grimjack comic days back at first and, you know, continuing now that you guys talk about with the Bucket of Suds. And
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I mean, if there was a Mundins on Earth, it was the Bucket. The late Kim used to say that if she encountered somebody who said that he was from Mars and that he had a spaceship parked out back, she would have to go out to the back just to check.
Let's talk about, while we mentioned Grimjack, what's going on over there? Now, I know it's been online at Comic Mix, and IDW has been printing the stories after they've been online?
Yep. Yeah, there's a Grimjack omnibus coming out pretty soon, I think, actually. I think it's coming out in June. And there's a new collection of Munden's Bar stories, most of which I think has appeared online, but not all. And that, I think, is coming out in, I think Amazon said September. I sometimes get surprised by these things, too, when I hear when everybody else hears on some of this. But we did the most recent Grimjack story online initially, and I think it's still there if you want to see it. Certainly is available in the individual issues, and I think at some point it will probably be collected together into a single format.
Fantastic. Has any of your stuff moved to... you've got it on the web right now, but are you going to try and reformat it at all for smartphones or the iPad, obviously? Although the iPad could pretty much take, I think, what's currently online at Comic Mix.
That I don't know. I don't know whether you'd fit on the iPhone as well, but I think certainly, they could put it on the iPad. I think, frankly, that's going to be the future of a lot of comics anyway.
Sure.
Is that you're going to see a lot of stuff, electronically that you can either get through the iPad or through the computer.
Do you see yourself maybe doing some sort of added content, like commentary or anything like that?
No, to be honest, I haven't. I sort of like the, I mean, if people ask me questions, certainly I'm willing to answer, but I generally like the story to speak for itself.
Okay.
I think, there may be some curiosity about, why'd you do this and why'd you do that? And again, if somebody asks me, I'm certainly willing to, to answer questions. But in general, I think, the story just stands by itself and works that way.
Very cool. Are there future plans for more Grimjack?
Well, I know that Tim and I at some point would like to do so. It depends upon his schedule,
Sure.
And stuff like that, but I definitely don't think that we've done our last Grimjack story.
Would you do something if Tim couldn't be involved, or does it have to be the two of you to do it?
Well, right now, primarily with Tim, but I wouldn't mind, doing something with Flint Henry again, or Tom Mandrake as well.
Sure.
These are all guys who put their own imprints on Grimjack as well. But I think, actually, in terms of what's most saleable, I think the readers are most interested in Tim and I doing stuff together. But who knows? Maybe at some point, we'll do an untold tale of the Flint Henry Grimjack.
when we first talked, we talked a little bit about your beginnings at First Comics. But I'm interested in what the comics community was like back then in terms of, hanging out and stuff. Who else was here? I know, like a lot of you, like Mike Gold, Mike Grell. Was Tim in Chicago as well when First was happening?
Tim was actually in Wisconsin.
Okay.
So he wasn't far away. Although he and I initially started working on Grimjack without actually having met. I remember the first time that I went up to Lake Geneva, which is where he was around at the time, and meeting him the first time, I'm just going, I hope this works, because otherwise we could have problems. But for the moment I got off the train and stuff like that, we just became good, fast friends real quick.
And, Bill Reinhold is still up here, and he's part of the first group as well. Did you guys, would you guys hang out in Evanston? Where would you guys hang out? Did you hang out, or was it all, 9 to 5, turning in your work, and then...
When we hung out together, it would generally be at conventions.
Okay.
Particularly the Chicago Con.
Sure.
At that point, we were still just meeting people and stuff like that for the first time. I know Tim and I were at a convention in the early days that wasn't in Chicago, and Will Eisner was one of the guests, and we kept on nudging each other. Well, you can go up and say hello to him? No, will you go up and say hello? This was Will Eisner, for crying out loud. How do you do that? And then we wound up sharing the shuttle bus out to the airport with him. And we had this wonderful conversation with him. And then after he got off, we both slapped our foreheads and said, we could have spent the entire weekend with him. So we were just sort of going, oh, we're saps.
Did you get to know him in the years after that?
Yeah. I got to talk with him a lot more. You know, a very approachable guy.
Did he? Did he have input in your on your spirit story that you got to do in the 90s?
No. Basically, it was. I mean, certainly he had to say it was okay. When it was proposed, but Will was very generous. With those stories, I thought. Allowing people to do different takes and interpretations of the spirit. Mandrake and I were just trying to do something very much in the form and mold, serve an homage rather than trying to take the spirit into new places.
And I felt like I stepped on you, John. You said you got to know him a little bit better on the years ahead and everything.
I did. I'm just saying, he's always very easy and very approachable to talk to. I remember the one time I met Jack Kirby, out in San Diego, and again, this was early in my career, and I was sitting at the first table, and Kim was sitting with me, and Jack and Julie Schwartz and a bunch of others go walking past, and I went, that's Jack Kirby, and I knew Julie a bit at that point, so I called Julie over, I said, Julie, would you introduce me to the king? Yeah, and he goes, and he looks at me like I'm demented, and he says, it's Jack, just go up and say hi. And said, no, I can't do that. He's a king, come on, Julia, pal, would you? And Julia said, come on. So he went up and he introduced me, and Jack shook my hand and said, hi, how are you? And I just sort of burbled something and stammered and turned into like this 13-year-old. Right in front of everyone's eyes. I just became a fan geek again.
We do the same. This happens at the cons when you meet your heroes and stuff. And, honestly, it was thrilling for me to meet, and see you guys in Rosemont at a small show at the Ramada. It was you. It was Grell, Gold, and I can't remember if Tim was there. I don't think Tim was there.
No, I don't think Tim was at that one.
But, it was fascinating. And you guys were just talking about First Comics. And I know I covered this in our first interview as well. I grew up in Wilmette. So mm-hmm. I was really close to where you guys were when you were getting started. And I was in high school. And mm-hmm. and just as you were kicking yourself not talking to Eisner, I wish I had known that you guys were as close as you were. Because I probably would have been one of those fan stalkers outside of First and everything. Yeah. Hoping to catch you guys coming into work or leaving.
It's funny. I mean, I've met Gail Simone at a couple of conventions, and she has told me that I'm one of her heroes, which is very flattering, but Gail's such a terrific writer on her own. And I emailed her at one point, because we were talking about something, and I just said, now, you may not know, but I wrote this, and she emailed back. She says, no, John, you don't understand. When I say I've read everything, I have read everything.
That's cool.
That you've written. So Gail's been terrific. She's been such a sweetheart. She helped so much during the whole benefit thing. And then she brought me on, gave me a shout to do a fill-in on the Secret Six and then the whole crossover with Blackest Night and stuff like that.
Yes, let's talk about those issues because,
sure.
Man, I got to tell you, again, first of all, I think it was issue 15 or 16,
yeah.
Your Deadshot issue. In 22 pages, boom. Great story, reminding people who gave Deadshot his modern spin.
Yeah.
Am I correct? He goes back to the Dick Sprang era, doesn't he?
Yeah. Basically, originally he wrote a tuxedo, or he wore a tuxedo, and a pair of Texas six guns and a top hat. I just thought that was ludicrous. But then he was later redesigned by Marshall Rogers. For a story that Steve Englehart wrote, which was, I just thought it was so cool looking and stuff. And I always wanted to go back and sort of retell Deadshot's origin, but I wanted to sort of spruce it up, I can bring it up to date with who he is now and sort of incorporate some of those elements. Although at start, I was determined that I was just going to eliminate the whole tuxedo and six guns things because I just thought it was so stupid looking, and the editor Sean Ryan asked me, "Oh, but please, I love it. Can you find some way to work it in?" And then it occurred to me how to do it, so I did. I threw it in there, and actually it worked very nicely. I was very pleased
absolutely
with it. The interesting thing for me in that story was I was actually having problems with it, because originally I was just going to have this framing device, and I figured it didn't matter what the framing device was. But I was wrong. The framing device was absolutely important. Originally, I was just going to have him chatting with Catman, and Catman saying, well, yeah, how'd you get started? You know, I can...
Okay.
The judge just spills it. You know, I went... And then the reason I was having so much trouble with it was I was going, no, it has to matter who he's talking to and why he's why is he telling this? And once I solved that, then the whole story just came real quick.
Yeah, and that's the great thing. This story not only ties back to, you know, elements of Suicide Squad, but also, you know, you get your Spectre run in there as well with the appearance. And forgive me, I'm forgetting the father.
Father Kramer.
Father Kramer, yes, the Reverend Kramer. It was really exciting to see, and I think you did a good job of informing people that don't remember the character as well. But it was really cool. And then in the process of the three issues that you did in Secret Six, you got to cover a lot of old, you know, fun ground. And I think bring people up to speed and hopefully get them excited, too, for the repackaging of Suicide Squad that's coming up later this year.
Yeah. 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 You know, yeah. That's also coming out, what, I think around June, July, something around like that. So, yeah, I'm very excited to actually see the Suicide Squad coming back out as well. I think it'll work terrifically in black and white.
I agree with you. And, yeah, Luke McDonald's art was always such an exciting thing to see.
Yeah.
It really was one of my favorite books back then, and you know the 1-2 punch of JLA and Suicide Squad were such really interesting books. Now JLA had more of a, you know, humor edge to it,
mm-hmm.
but you guys were really able to, you know, mix the action and the humor in such an effective way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean we had that whole run of who was throwing pies at people. We ran that for about a year and a half, I think, before we finally answered it definitively.
Well, and I think you've introduced something new in this Blackest Night tie-in, pitting the squad against the Secret Six, and great confrontations with Amanda Waller and Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
And for people, if you missed it, you really need to go out and get it. And I see that they are collecting a lot of the little runs and miniseries. I hope that yours is collected. And actually,
yeah, I believe it's going to be.
Great, because, you know, honestly, John, it would make a great absolute Suicide Squad, should they ever decide to do that,
mm-hmm.
to include the Deadshot one-shot,
mm-hmm.
and also the two-parter of Blackest Night, because there's a lot of fertile ground there. And, of course, you've left the door open. Now, I don't know if that's for Gail's purposes in the future, or if you're going to have the opportunity to, you know, kind of address the confrontation between Waller and Floyd.
Yeah. Yeah, that depends on who, you know, who gets a chance to do it. It's definitely Gail's book, you know.
Sure.
And it was really fun co-writing it, you know, with her as well. So I just, you know, pleased to have the opportunity, and the reception was just really, really gratifying to see. You know, people were very excited by it, and it sold well, from what I'm told.
Fantastic. Well, and, you know, I got to be honest, there were some characters that I didn't remember. I didn't remember that other Adam from
mm-hmm.
that ended up as a Black Lantern and everything. And I'm like,
yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to go back and check that out, man.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was in the early, that was around 1990, I guess, that you had him debut in one of your issues of Suicide Squad.
Mm-hmm.
What's his name again?
His name is Adam Crane.
Thank you.
And everybody assumed at the time that he was actually Ray Palmer, going by a different name. And then we killed him. They went, whoa, 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 what? And then Ray Palmer actually showed up.
That's really cool, because, yeah, I'm like, you know, I just didn't remember that character. And I always said, okay, Ray Palmer. And then the character Gail just finished writing, Ryan Choi. But I had completely missed Adam Cray, so I was like, oh, I got to read this guy and see what the hell his deal is.
Yeah.
So that's where Wikipedia
actually,
comes
when
in
you
handy.
Right down to it, the concept of the Adam would work really well with a spy group like the Squad.
You know, and I wonder if that kind of, you're right, and I think that kind of Black Ops espionage kind of arm of the Justice League or whatever would be good. But yeah, I think you're right. It would work better with the Squad or the Secret Six. How was it coming back? I enjoyed your miniseries a couple years ago when you had the Squad come back.
Oh, thanks.
And, you know, I mean, I don't know. I still think there's, even though Secret Six is doing great and I'm very happy for Gail, I hope there's room for you know, a new Suicide Squad, because there's certainly still enough characters, among them the Bronze Tiger, one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Always happy to see him back. And again, the Wall. I mean, I was glad that Greg Rucka was using Amanda in...
Smallville.
Well, also Checkmate.
Yeah.
There were definitely a lot of threads of the Suicide Squad in Checkmate. But, it was great to see the character back in your hands, and I have a feeling you've got a lot more to say about Amanda Waller if given the chance.
Well, the fun thing about writing Amanda is that even after so much time away, I just sat down, I opened the channel, and there she was. I didn't have to think hard about what her dialogue was. You know, Gail said one of her favorite bits of dialogue was right at the end when... she gets asked, Amanda, does your right hand ever know what your left hand is doing? And her answer is only on a need-to-know basis.
Big revelation at the end of that story that, and I guess for our purposes we should have mentioned it, because if you haven't read it, Amanda Waller is Mockingbird, and she is the one that is controlling the Secret Six.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Gail's idea.
Very cool. Well, that's important. I mean, if there's something dirty going on in the DC universe, Amanda probably should be involved in some way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, the odd thing is, you can't just play her as someone who, enjoys doing dirty deeds. The thing is, she does have a conscience, and she just doesn't always listen to it. And she has reasons for doing what she does, but she isn't doing it just to be nasty, it has to serve a purpose.
Going back to that Deadshot issue, too, I loved those quick flashes of what's going on in Floyd's mind and what he'd like to be doing versus what's happening in the now.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really handled well, both by Jim Calafiore from a drawing standpoint and your colorist as well. And I don't know who the colorist was, but, those were very good kind of shocking, good comic book moments, something like that really does work well in a comic book.
Yeah. Yeah. It's what I asked for in the script, and they just realized it so well. Jim did a spectacular job, not only on that, but also on the crossover.
Absolutely.
Well.
Yeah, and again, so much fun seeing so many of these characters come back. And, I really do, John. I hope that you're given that opportunity. Count me as one fan that wants to see you working more on Suicide Squad, because I think you have a lot to say with these characters.
Yeah, well, I've been talks with DCs with DC about some projects. We'll see whether or not they like any of them, whether or not they take off. But I certainly would like to play in DC's sandbox again. And always had a good time there.
And it always seems like, you were given, or maybe this is just the way it is when, you are trying to break into with the big two, is to come with them with ideas for C-list characters. And it seems like, you've always been very successful in that, whether it's been Hawkman or the Martian Manhunter or, again, the Spectre.
Yeah, or the fact that, Oracle started in Suicide Squad.
I forgot about that. You're absolutely right.
We're the ones, Kim Yale and I, were the ones who recreated Barbara Gordon as Oracle.
That's fantastic. That's really cool. Now, I'm glad to hear that you are able to watch films and television, because there have been some, we mentioned Amanda Waller being popping up in Smallville.
Mm-hmm.
And
just one of the ones who writes her really, really well.
Boy, just like C.C. Pounder doing it, the voice in the animated series, mm-hmm. Great casting on Smallville to put Pam Grier.
Pam Grier, for crying out loud. Jeez, how cool is that?
You tell me how cool that is.
That's pretty cool. at the moment when she says, "Welcome to the Suicide Squad," blam. I exchanged some emails with Greg. And Jeff told me, he said, "Yeah, I put that in there for you."
That's the cool thing, man, honestly. And I know guys across the street love you, too. I mean, Brian Bendis is a big fan of yours. We mentioned Greg Rucka, of course. And I know Ed Brubaker loves your stuff. Matt mm-hmm. Fraction loves your stuff. I mean, that's the thing, John. And I know you're busy with Star Wars, but I hope that there is room at and in your schedule and over at some of the big two to see you back on some of these characters. Because
oh, absolutely. There's definitely the room in my schedule. I'm looking for a little more work, so we'll see what happens.
Very cool, man. And then, did you have a chance to see the Spectre short that's in the new Justice League animated DVD?
No, that I haven't seen yet. I think I saw a glimpse of it, but no, that I haven't seen yet.
Because now it really takes the Fleischer Apero years, and it really is that story. But again, I was listening to our first conversation, and I think they kind of captured what you said mattered most about doing the Spectre these days, or ever trying to come back to the Spectre. And rather than dealing with the godlike powers, dealing with the man who has them, and the dead man at the time, Jim Corrigan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you get that flavor as well in the short that they made for this DVD.
Cool. Cool. Well, I have to remember to go out and see if I can rent it. Make a trip over to Blockbuster.
It's have you interest in the new Spectre, this Crispus Attucks, or were you do you feel like Corrigan was enough, and the run that you had in the '80s was what you wanted to say about the character?
Well, I always think that one of the reasons we took Corrigan out of the equation was to give people a new chance to do what they wanted to do with the Spectre at that point. I don't know if I would want to go back for like an extended thing on the Spectre, because the Spectre really reflected pretty much reflected a lot of where I was at the time. I'm not at that place.
I understand.
Anymore. So, but I think that the Spectre remains a very strong, viable character if you know what you're doing with the character. One of the reasons that Tom and I both wanted to take him on was, first of all, we loved the character, and we wanted to find a way to make sure that you got all the visual punch that the Spectre was all about, and at the same time, do a story that had character in it and was character-driven at the same time. And our solution was to focus on Corrigan.
What do you think of what the big two are doing right now in terms of the connected stories? I mean, the big event has kind of been the umbrella for the entire line of both DC and Marvel. And, is that an environment that you would be comfortable working in? Or, I think to some of your best projects like Wasteland and even the Kents and stuff, these are books that kind of were able to, kind of be in their own corner. It's the Spectre, too, for that matter.
Yeah, but on the other hand, when I needed to, I could always play well with others,
Sure. Well, you just did, obviously, doing the Blackest Night stuff too.
Yeah, right. I mean, that was plenty of fun. We had time to work in what they needed, plus what we wanted to do as well. So, and make it a real big confrontation between the six and the squad. What we also wanted to do there was sort of define what was the difference between the six and the squad as well, which I think we did. So it's just a matter of being open, being flexible, understanding what are the rules, and then play as best you can within the rules. Like I said, sometimes you do a fill-in and or a single issue, and part of the rules there is you're not going to be playing with the ongoing continuity, you're not going to be playing with most of the supporting staff, and yet at the same time you need to tell a good, compelling story in and of itself that will make people glad that they spent the money on it. So there's always rules, but if you know what you're doing, you can really play with them and make them work for you.
Years ago, you mentioned that you had an idea for the Challengers of the Unknown. And, I don't want you to tip anything that you've got brewing over at DC, but are there any characters or ideas that you had that were dismissed that you're like, oh, too bad, that you wouldn't mind sharing? Or is
I don't think what I was planning at the time would probably be applicable now.
Okay.
If I was to, if they said, okay, here's the book, Challengers of the Unknown, I would probably chuck what I was doing and try to approach it fresh. Because you can't just keep on those ideas are what, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old.
Okay.
You got to approach it, as where it is right now. Where is the industry right now? Where is the particular universe that you're in at the moment? And then make it work from there.
Last time we talked a lot about Wasteland, and one of my favorite series. Any update on a possible collection? Do you know if that's in Bob Wayne's radar at all, or is that?
I don't know. To be honest, I don't think anybody's talked about it much. I've played with the idea of doing Wasteland type stories from time to time. I can maybe,
sure,
collect and then see if I can't put out something called Illegitimate Bastard Son of Wasteland or something.
Are there some untold Del Close tales that would still make?
No, and that would be the other problem. You know, with Del no longer around, you know, it's not quite the same animal.
I could appreciate that. You know, again, man, I'm telling you, that series was of its time and ahead of its time, because I really think if it was coming out today, it would be, first of all, I think Karen Berger would have grabbed it from the DCU and said, yeah, let me play with this. Mm-hmm. And I really think that the formats today would support the book better. I don't know why, but I really think that there's room for Wasteland, I think, more so now than maybe when it was coming out. Because I don't know how well it sold back in the day, but, man, I'm telling you, that was just, for me, it represented what the direct market could be as opposed to the newsstand. And it had that kind of excitement behind it.
Well, part of our joke at the time was to see, you know, like, okay, what will it take to drive our audience away? How long can we last until we force so many of our audience away that that we have to stop doing it or that we get canceled? We originally thought, you know, we'll be lucky if we make 12. Well, we got up to 18, and we really stopped at that point was because it was taking so much out of me. You know, it was taking almost as long to do a single story for that as it would to write an entire issue of something else.
Wow.
So economically, it just wasn't feasible for me anyway. I was just, you know, we set a bar pretty high, you know, like with that. And so after that, it became, you know, if you're trying to hit somewhere around that, you know, then it gets to be, you know, very tough month after month.
Who was your artist on that series?
Let's see, Bill Loves was one.
Okay.
David Lloyd was one for a while.
Right, yes, I do remember David Lloyd on the book, yes.
We originally had four. Yeah, again, we'd have three in the book and then one doing the cover. Kind of hard to remember who the other two were.
You know, I've got the internet right in front of me, so that's funny. I should actually... I know David Lloyd's going to be coming to C2E2.
Yeah.
That's a conversation I'm going to have with him, what it was like working with you guys.
He did some wonderful stuff. He did some wonderful stuff.
And, man, with 18 issues, I just think that would, again, make... You know, they've got these Absolute collections where they got the big, giant hardcover and stuff. That would be perfect for that, I'm telling you, an Absolute Wasteland. It just represents such an interesting combination of the art, your storytelling, and Del's ideas as well. And I'm sure that you know, were carrying the water and doing, you know, the majority of the actual writing, but I'm sure the story sessions talking to Del had to have been a blast.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, Del and I knew each other besides that.
Sure.
But even on the stories that Del didn't write, there was a sensibility that that went through the whole thing, both a sense of horror as psychological horror and humor. Gold used to call black hole humor, you know, humor so black, so dark, you know, that no laughs were escaping from it. I remember when I wrote solo on one of the stories called Sonnet, there was that basically used one of Shakespeare's sonnets. I remember Del calling me up. And one of the highlights for me of working on the whole thing was Del telling me, now that was genius.
That's cool.
Because, I mean, Del was a genius. You know, not always an easy person to know or be around, but a certifiable genius so far as I'm concerned.
Well, and if for people who haven't heard my first interview with you, to explain who Del Close is, comedy teacher for decades, you know, goes back to the pre-Second City years of, I want to say, the Compass Players, maybe?
Yeah, there was the Committee, the Compass Players. I mean, he goes back to the birth of, you know, the incarnations before Second City that then became Second City, and then he went on to the Improv Olympics
yes.
as well.
And
he was actor, he was director, he was teacher. And I think it's particularly in terms of him as teacher and director, because of so many comedic minds that he touched and influenced, that he's one of the, you know, truly one of the biggest influences in American comedy in the latter half of the last century. And his influence is just going to continue to grow and be felt, you know, because the people that he taught then go on and carry it on.
Guys from Bill Murray to Mike Myers and Chris Farley to Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau,
And Colbert.
And Stephen Colbert, absolutely. Yes, and that's really cool. And I know he was a friend of yours and a co-collaborator for Munden's Bar and for Wasteland as well. And, yeah, it must have been a hell of a hell of a tennis partner.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, sometimes he could be maddening, and sometimes he was, you know, he would just come in with this amazing stuff. You know, like, and sometimes, you know, particularly on the ones that we truly worked on together, you know, like, it was just, you know, really, really amazing, because we would sit together and we'd be plotting, you know, and then go, yeah, and then this happens, and that happens. In fact, one of my favorite stories is dissecting Mr. Fleming, which definitely is a collaboration between Dell and me.
Remind people of that story, if you wouldn't mind.
It starts with the fact that this boy's father has dissected his biology teacher on the gymnasium floor for having forced the boy to dissect a frog. And the boy and his father have this amazing, amazing discussion as they try to decide what they're going to do. Now the fact that Mr. Fleming has been dissected.
You know, and I looked it up, and let's see, Don Simpson, David Lloyd, William Esther Loeb, and Tim Truman, of course.
Yeah.
And then I forgot about this, but I know I've got the issue somewhere in my back issues. One issue with Joe Orlando as well.
Yeah. It was called Titty Cat Breath.
Fantastic. No, yeah. this is why, man. This, I'm telling you, we really got to bug DC about putting this out, because it really was this wonderful series for a year and a half that should not be forgotten.
Yeah, the only time that we repeated anything was with the Dead Detective stories that Bill Loeb's did, Bill, Mr. Loeb's.
Yep.
And that was one of my favorites, because that just was so peculiar.
Yes.
The poor dead detective going, well, this probably makes sense eventually, and it never does.
Well, what's coming up for you now? Obviously, you know, you've got your Star Wars work coming, as you say, some potential projects at DC. It's been a while since you've worked in Marvel. Any interest or ideas for Marvel? Are you talking about those guys?
Well, of course, I certainly have interest. Yeah, you know, I've talked a little bit with somebody over there. I don't want to
understand
anybody. But again, you know, there's possibilities. You know, I love the world, you know, where there's possibilities. You know, so we'll see. I would certainly hope to. I would like to expand things out a bit more. At some point, I would like to try my hand at a novel or two or three.
You know, I was wondering that, because you, really, John, you've written for stage, you've written comics, and I was wondering, and actually, I spoke to Steve Englehart last week, and he has a new novel out and everything, and again, I think your life and the people that have been in your life. There's got to be a few novels rattling around in your head.
Yeah. I mean, like, I've got ideas for novels. It's a matter of that a lot of time you spend a lot of the time just, doing what you need to do in order to pay the bills. And when you spend a lot of time on that, then you sometimes don't get the spare time that you would like to. I have written a couple short stories that have gotten out there. And I even did an essay for supervillains and philosophy.
Where's that at?
That's a trade paperback, and the editor, both Daniel O'Neill and I both have essays in there using the idea of supervillains and stuff. And those who, again, like Suicide Squad, may be interested in it, because while Amanda Waller isn't in it. But there is this whole talk about the morality of what the Suicide Squad does. What is the morality and the philosophical basis of it?
What's the title of the collection?
It's called Supervillains and Philosophy.
Did Denny also participate, or was he the editor?
Yes, Denny O'Neill has an essay in there as well.
Okay.
So, along with a bunch of philosophers. Paid philosophers, accredited philosophers, and then a geek like me.
A geek who knows how to write actions, man, and interesting stories.
Well,
that's all right.
We're trying to do action-packed philosophy.
Have you seen Action Philosophers? We laugh, but Fred Van Lente and Ryan Dunleavy, that's a cute little book that they've had. That and a book called Comic Book Comics, where they've done the history of comic books in comic book form.
Cool.
But yeah, exactly. So a couple other titles to check out.
Yeah, I recently came across and reread an issue of The Spectre, where that was late in the run, where there was this whole question of if God doesn't exist, then is The Spectre just delusional?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, and what is motivating his cause?
Yeah, so we got into these whole theological questions, during the run of The Spectre. So, and I think it still stands up.
I don't want to cheat people out of reading your essay, but what are your thoughts as far as supervillain?
Well, the funny thing is, I'm not arguing basically my philosophy. I'm arguing what would be Amanda's point of view, and we do it as a dialogue. Essentially, there's this person I made up who's supposedly overseeing the squad as a division of the government, and talking with someone who's come in from the new administration, from the Obama administration, to see if this is justifiable. So they have this whole question about what the squad does and what's the basis and how can it be justified.
Is this,
and so that becomes the whole basis for what is basically a philosophical conversation.
And is this out now, or is this coming?
Oh yeah. You can probably find it on Amazon.
Okay.
I can order it from there. And because I want to do something that'd be Socratic in nature. In other words, and do it as a dialogue.
Sure.
So I think it's sometimes a little easier to read as a result, because it reads like a dialogue.
Very cool. No, I'm gonna have to look for that. I think that's fantastic. And of course, people need to look for the collected Star Wars Legacy and going back to your Republic years as well.
Mm-hmm.
All well represented, I'm sure, at Amazon.com and at Dark Horse and various comic book stores online and locally as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool. And by all means, folks, go back and if you haven't read those recent issues of Secret Six, they might still be on the racks at your store. So you should catch them or catch them when they're collected. And we look forward to seeing the Suicide Squad recollected. And I think that's going to be fantastic, and really looking forward to that. But we want more news stories from John Ostrander, so I'm glad to hear that you're doing okay, and it sounds like there's more stuff in the pipeline, so this is great.
I hope so, yeah.
And hope to see you soon at one of the cons. As I say, C2E2.
That'd be great.
Beyond the Chicago convention, what are your future convention plans?
I don't know yet. There's a possibility that I'll be at the next big Star Wars Celebration convention. I think that's in August.
Okay. We'll likely see you maybe at the New York show?
Oh, that's a possibility. Again, it depends upon what else I have to do that weekend.
Sure.
Vote is. But I'll know better as I get closer to that time.
Okay. Well, that's great, John, and glad to hear that that you're doing good. Continued success. I mean, it's been a pleasure reading you for the time that I have, and look forward to reading more new stuff.
Well, thanks. It's been great talking with you.
So a bunch of great new and reprinted books of John Ostrander's are going to be hitting the stands in the weeks and months ahead. Keep your eyes out for them. Make sure you take full advantage of your local comic book store or your favorite online store and check out these great books by John Ostrander. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. John Suntris reminding you that Word Balloon is all over the internet. Come to our website, wordballoon.com. Make sure you check out our archive of 300 shows featuring your favorite artists, writers, animators, actors, directors, writers, all waiting for you at wordballoon.com. The show is also available at iTunes. It'd be great if you want to rate the show and leave us a review over there. And remember, too, you can follow me on Twitter under John Word Balloon, at Facebook under my name, or questions or comments about the show can either be left at the Word Balloon message board at wordballoon.com, or you can email me, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.